Hello and welcome to the Many Rules of Film Club. My name is Jeff Yance. I am the program director at the Loft Cinema. And today we have with us, as always, occasional filmmaker Heather Lattis.
Hello.
And multimedia artist Rusty Boulay Stevenson.
No beer and no TV make Rusty something something.
Well, that's a good tease, Rusty, because today, in honor of the impending Halloween holiday, we are going to be discussing the cinema of Stephen King, or the cinema of films based on works by Stephen King. So Stephen King, one of the most famous living authors, without a doubt.
Yes.
I think perhaps everyone, maybe I'm just speaking for myself, has gone through the Stephen King phase, where you just read anything you can get your hands on. Did you both have a Stephen King phase?
I didn't have. Okay. I've read a few of his books. They're very readable.
Yes.
They're page turners. That's the thing that Stephen King does well, is he's got a story and he tells it. And it keeps you turning pages.
Yeah, he's very descriptive. I've only recently started reading a Stephen King book. I started reading Christine, and I'm just a few chapters in, and I can see why people are go on a Stephen King binge, because he's very easy to read, even though it's scary a lot of times, but I enjoy it so far.
Yeah, and I was a big horror fan as a kid, so I started reading them, I think, in junior high. I think I jumped right from The Boxcar Children into The Shining, you know. Cujo,
yeah,
and
you know,
The Stand, whatever. So I read as much as I could get my hands on, and I think he's a really undervalued writer. I think because he's so popular, he's not seen as a literary writer, and he may not be literary per se, but I think he's a great writer.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he definitely is. He's a great storyteller. I took a lot of literature classes in college, and it came up kind of regularly. And in our literature classes, it certainly wasn't considered literature.
Right.
Stephen King.
What? Really?
Yeah. No, I mean, it just wasn't considered something that we would be reading in class. No. I never had to read a Stephen King book for any
That's
class
true.
That I was
never
in.
Read any. That's true.
I took a lot of lit classes.
Yes, me too.
So it came up, and I think people who are really into literature do kind of look down on Stephen King. I have in my life looked down on Stephen
oh,
King.
Oh, the truth comes out.
The one thing that I keep going back to, and having watched a lot of Stephen King movies now, and I've read a few of his books, is that he's just a great storyteller. He really is. He's got a story, and what I always keep going back to and just thinking about it is, if I sat down to write a book, I would talk myself out of it. Oh, I'm not the best writer. Oh, I can't do that. This isn't an original enough idea. Stephen King doesn't let any of that get in his way.
No.
He is going to sit down, and he's going to write a book that people are going to turn the pages and read, even if it's not the best dialogue, even if it's not the best description. It still is such a good story that I think that it makes for fun reading.
Yeah, I mean, this is a man who's written, I think it's 56 novels in a 42-year span.
Yeah,
that's more than a novel a year. I mean, that's crazy output.
Yeah.
So I wonder how many pages, because his books are big. I wonder how many pages a day he's written, if you all his published work.
Well, I know he has some sort of formula that he has to write a certain number of pages every day, and he devotes a certain number of hours to writing every day. So he's very disciplined.
Yeah, you have to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of my friends mentioned something that made sense, is that she noticed that Stephen King novels are very readable out loud. So they're easy to read to someone else.
Right.
It's a flow instead of, maybe that's why literature people don't, like, it's not as brain challenging.
Right.
But it's easy to read out loud as well.
That's interesting. That's the first Stephen King that I was introduced to, probably, was my mom reading part of Stand By Me out loud. She read the part about Lardass big joke. So that was the first time, was my mom reading that aloud as we were camping. Oh my gosh, we laughed and laughed and laughed, right? That's great storytelling. That's great storytelling.
Well, so Stephen King is obviously not just a horror writer, right? Science fiction, thrillers. He's written a lot of nonfiction. Mm-hmm. We were talking earlier, one of the best, I think, books on writing I have read is called On Writing by Stephen King.
Agreed.
So he's a multi-talented. He's been honored by the National Book Foundation for distinguished contributions to literature, which riled a lot of authors that he received that award.
Snooty authors.
Snooty authors. I think he deserved it. But we're kind of focusing on his horror and sci-fi
mostly
output today because in honor of Halloween. So he started in the 70s, 74, with Carrie, his first novel. And so I think that's a good place to start. Maybe just talk about Carrie. The movie adaptation came out in 76, 2 years later.
By Brian De Palma.
Brian De Palma.
Starring Sissy Spacek as the title character, Carrie, and Piper Laurie as her mom.
Oh, she was so great.
Who's really
so
great and crazy. Really scary and crazy. It's one I that was my first Stephen King book I read. I read it as a sophomore in high school. And it's a really interesting book in that it doesn't tell a linear story. You're getting the story broken up in different ways. You've got three different narrators and points of view that it'll tell you part of that person's story. And sometimes it'll be stuff that was in the future. There's a dictionary entry even in the book, like to pull a carry or something to cause great destruction.
Right.
And so it's a really interesting book. I really enjoyed the format. And the movie does not have that format at all. The original movie or the remakes, you couldn't really do that in a movie the way they did. And it would be difficult to do. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. But the movie by Brian De Palma is, I watched it again just recently, probably the third or fourth time I've watched it over the course of a number of years. And it's amazing how well it translates for a modern audience, I feel like. It moves at a really quick pace. For it being 1970s, it's an hour and a half long, and the pace of the movie is really quick. It doesn't stall at all. It really moves. And I really like that about it. I think that Brian De Palma really had great pacing for the film.
Yeah, and great style. It's a really stylish movie with the slow motion sequences and the swirling cameras and the split screens.
Yeah, and the jump cuts to some really neat stuff that he does in it and telling and if you're not familiar with the story of Carrie, Carrie is a young woman who's being raised by her mom, and her mom is really evangelical Christian in a super crazy way. In a way, she quotes what she seems to think are Bible references, but that aren't. Everything right. she says yeah. that she the original sin was fornication. Well, no, that's not in the Bible. What the heck? Where's that come from? You know. And so it makes Carrie a little crazy at home, and she's picked on at school. The movie starts with her being picked on.
Yes, very horribly in the shower. Yeah.
In the shower.
Sequence, yeah.
Yeah, it is an infamous sequence where she has her period for the first time, and because of her mom's religious zealotry, she doesn't know what's happening to her. She thinks she's dying. Mm-hmm. And then the girls start throwing tampons at her and yelling at her. And it makes for a pretty horrific thing. And then as the movie progresses, you realize that, and Carrie starts to realize that she has telekinetic powers. She can make, and it happens in the shower scene, like a light bulb busts when she's super frustrated.
Right.
And so you slowly start realizing that she's causing these things to happen. And it spirals out, as they make more fun of her, the gym teacher forces all the girls to have to run laps and have to do all this stuff, or they can't go to senior prom. Mm. And the one main antagonist of Carrie decides, screw it, I'm not going to run these things. I'm going to not go to prom, but I'll instead pull the worst prank on Carrie ever. And I mean, I can't imagine I'm spoiling anything with Carrie. We all know what happens. Yes. It's, you know, she gets dumped, blood gets dumped on her, pig blood.
At the prom. Worst prom ever.
Worst prom ever.
Yeah, I had a terrible prom ever. But this is much worse.
And then she proceeds to unleash all of her telekinetic ability that now she's got power of. And she's so mad, I think the idea is that it's worse and she's more powerful when she's this angry, and destroys everything. And it's interesting in the 70s, it really, as a modern viewer, you think of Columbine and you think of these school shootings and stuff right away now.
Right. And it's interesting the perspective that you have, because you really, she's such a sympathetic character, which is, I think, a tribute to Sissy Spacek's great performance, that you really are rooting for her to kill these classmates, which is a very odd position to be in as a viewer and uncomfortable. Yeah. You want her to take revenge.
Yeah.
And you want her to kill her mother. You want her to kill all her tormentors. And she does.
You want her to have character to get some justice in that cruel, cruel world she lives in.
Yeah. Well, and that's it. She's in a super cruel world. Like we were talking about a little bit ago, Heather. Carrie, for most of us, high school is always, and junior high in particular, is a mean place for kids and for young adults as they're growing up. You know, that we all go through a lot of hard times. Our bodies are doing crazy stuff. And so we all have hard times. But home is always a place where you can go and you're enveloped in love, and that harshness of high school isn't there. Carrie doesn't have that in the book. Instead, her mom makes her sit in the closet and locks her in a closet and say crazy Bible verses that aren't real. And so Carrie doesn't have that. And so you really feel bad for her. You don't see that she has any place to go at all.
Right.
Everything is antagonistic towards Carrie.
And I think one reason the movie holds up, this is the 40th anniversary this year, is because it really taps into the kind of current bullying climate that we have now.
Yes.
It seems like a new thing now, even though it's been going on
forever
since schools existed and since there have been children. But I think Carrie really taps into that because I think we all feel for her and we all felt like outsiders in high school, even if we weren't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's right.
So it's really resonant today and it doesn't really get stale, I think.
No, it's easy to identify with Carrie, and it is an odd position, but you do want her, when she slams those doors with her telekinetic powers, you want her to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, you're bloodthirsty yourself at that point. And right. That's interesting that a movie can do that to you.
Well, it's shot so well, the part where she's on the stage and she's, you know, she thinks she's having one of the happiest moments of her life. And then the blood happens.
Yeah.
And it's shot so well, and the editing of that whole gym scene is put together so nicely that it creates that we want her to wreak havoc because look at what they're ruining for her, you know.
Yeah, she was actually having a good time with her date who you know, takes her out because his girlfriend asks. She feels bad about what they did to Carrie and wants to make it up. How can we help Carrie have a great night? And so you take her to prom. And when you see Carrie and he's like, oh, you look so beautiful. You really, I love those moments of the film. Like, I really identify somehow with that. You know, I really love that she's being treated so nicely and that it's genuine, that it's genuine. He's not being mean and he's not being fake about it. And the movie really conveys that very well.
Yeah. And it's almost interesting to watch Carrie now is that it's not a full on horror movie really until the end.
No.
Right.
It's a coming of age film and you really feel for this girl and you want her to be happy. And she's not going to get it. So it's kind of devastating at the end when that actually plays out. But I think that's Stephen King. He wrote it when he was a young man. I think just far enough out of high school that he could still remember how horrible high school really was.
Yeah.
I think an older person would maybe not have written something quite so visceral about high school.
Well, and the other thing about the book, too, is Carrie's not as likable as she is in the movie. In the book, she's made to sound pretty bad and to look pretty bad. And then as well, because of the flash forwards and the foreshadowing, you know that she's done really bad things. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, as a reader, you're not quite as sympathetic with Carrie as you are in the film, I think.
Right.
That was my take from having read it and us talking about it a little bit, is just that I think that the movie does something really interesting. And maybe this is an interesting point to talk about it. But, Jeff, is this one that Stephen King doesn't like most of the movies that have been made based on his books?
Yeah, he really doesn't like them. And I think this was the first one. So I have read that he has a soft spot because it was the first and it was successful.
And he made money for the first time.
And he made money for the first time. But I also have read that he didn't really feel like it captured the novel.
Mm. Yeah. Well, it doesn't.
It doesn't. And I think they made some very smart changes. And I think particularly making Carrie more sympathetic was important for a film because you identify differently with characters in a film than you do in literature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She had to be more likable. They had to cast an actress like Sissy Spacek, whom you were rooting for, you know.
Yeah. And no,
she is attractive. They try to make her look dowdy in the film, but she's a very attractive woman. But I think that's been the long history of Stephen King adaptations, is directors imposing their own vision on his material and him being uncomfortable with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think you have to, and you had to make the movie that way. And what points it out even more, or underscores it, is the fact that when it was remade for the second time in 2013, that they use almost the exact same formula and almost the exact same lines. It's a really good remake. I think we all tend to have knee-jerk reactions against any remakes. Julianne Moore is Carrie's mom in it. She's really good. I don't think she's better than Piper Laurie. Piper Laurie was probably legitimately crazy.
Yeah. Yes. I think off camera as well. Yes.
And funny thing, Piper Laurie still contends that the movie Carrie is a dark comedy.
What?
Well.
What? I never heard of that.
Yeah. No. She says that's how she did her lines, and why she was so over the top is because she thought
script. She freaked me out.
Yeah. Oh, she's great, but she thought it when she read the script that it was a dark comedy, and she still contends that it was a dark comedy. But
well, the dirty pillows line is pretty funny.
It's pretty funny.
Which has been mocked mercifully.
Yeah.
Throughout time. But that is interesting, sort of finding a different kind of level to the material, the humor.
Yeah.
Which has happened in a lot of Stephen King films. One in particular that I'm very taken with, one of my favorite Stephen King films, is The Shining, which came out in 1980, and it was maybe his third book, but the second film made from one of his books. So very early on in his career. That's also, to me, I look at The Shining as a little bit of a black comedy, even though it's also completely terrifying and disturbing. But The Shining, so just if there's anyone who's not familiar, I find it hard to believe, but possibly. It's basically about a writer who's a stand-in for Stephen King, I think, who is blocked, takes his family to a hotel where they are going to be the caretakers over the winter when the hotel is closed. The dad flips out. The family gets in trouble. Hijinks ensue.
Hijinks, wow. I never heard that word used with Shining.
Yeah. And it's great. And as a child, I found The Shining to be one of the most horrifying films I've ever seen.
Absolutely.
And I think you bring a lot of your own life to it. If you know, the idea that a parent is not really going to protect you, but they're going to take an axe to you.
Yeah.
For a kid, that's very disturbing. And this was based a little bit on Stephen King's own life. He said at the time when he was writing it, he was struggling with alcoholism for about a decade during that period. Also, I find interesting, he said he had unintended rage toward his family while he was making the book, while writing the book, which you can really feel.
Yeah.
You can really feel in the movie and the book that you just don't know where this anger is coming from towards the wife and the child. But it's there, and it's very real, and it's very scary. And then it's supernatural. There's a ghost story, obviously. So Stephen King has also, of course, said that he hated the movie version of The Shining.
Stanley Kubrick directed.
And I think if you have a director like Stanley Kubrick, who is such an auteur and someone who puts his personal stamp on everything, taking your material, it's going to be completely different.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is. And then Stephen King in the 97 made his own version of The Shining as a TV miniseries starring Tim Daly from Wings. So it's a little bit of a lesser, to me, a little bit of a lesser project.
Oh, I
think so.
But Stephen King was able to write that version and sort of make it the way he wanted to. He was always a little concerned that Kubrick's Shining got away from the supernatural elements and more towards the psychological element of this tortured writer just turning into a madman wanting to kill his family. But I think that the ambiguity in the movie is really, that's what makes it fascinating to me. You don't always know exactly whether he's imagining what's happening.
Mm. Oh, sure.
Or if there are really supernatural goings on at this hotel.
Danny, his son, seems to have, that's what the term The Shining is Danny's got some sort of ESP. He's got some sort of extra, extra sensory perception. It could be that he's creating even these things that his dad sees.
Exactly. And this metaphor for possibly he's been abused by his dad, so he's sort of conjuring up these visions as a way of sort of dealing with that.
And making his dad go crazy because he's abused.
Yeah. And interesting, so Jack Nicholson, of course, is great in the film, and I think Shelley Duvall is great as Wendy, the wife. In the book, The Shining, the wife is much more self-reliant and confident and powerful. And Kubrick made the decision to make her character in the film basically hysterical and falling apart at every moment, which a lot of people have criticized about the film, is that the woman is so powerless. But Stanley Kubrick said she had to be that way because there's no way you would ever believe that a strong, powerful woman would stay with the Jack Nicholson character. It wasn't believable that she had to be a bit of a pushover. So that was kind of a way that he sort of imposed his own view on the story, which I think is interesting. And of course, Kubrick notorious for like pushing his actors to extremes and sort of terrorizing Shelley Duvall to get this hysterical performance out of her. And Jack Nicholson is amazing. And that's one reason I think the film is funny, because Jack Nicholson's performance is so over the top, which also supposedly Stephen King hated. He said he didn't think Jack Nicholson was the right actor because you already think Jack Nicholson is crazy going into the movie. Because that's Jack Nicholson.
That's Jack Nicholson.
And you needed a more quote-unquote normal actor to pull that off. I think it's kind of a perfect, I mean, the way it is.
Oh, as a horror movie, is there a better horror movie that you guys can think of? That's my favorite horror movie, I think, by far. I don't think
it's way up there.
It's terribly close, even. Heather's really thinking about it. She's not ready to commit yet.
Well, yeah, I haven't really thought about it. That's a good question. I can't commit, but I would definitely say it's in the top for sure.
Yeah. It's one of the top five horror films of all time. Stanley Kubrick's mark is indelible on it. I mean, it's all over the place.
Oh, it's a Kubrick film.
It's a Kubrick film. There's so much subtext. And that's sometimes what we've talked about with Stephen King is sometimes Stephen King's subtext is just the story itself. That's what Stephen King is. He's not putting a ton of where. And there's a whole movie, a documentary, Room 237, that talks about a lot of the possible subtext that Kubrick put into the film.
Slash crazy conspiracy theories. We should point out that they're it's actually conspiracy theories. I mean, this movie has taken on its own life as an actual conspiracy theory.
Yes.
And you should see Room 237 if you haven't seen it.
Heather can't make it through it.
No, I made it halfway through. I will go back and finish the rest, but some of it was just too much. Like, I'm definitely a fan of Stanley Kubrick, to say the least. I love his movies for the most part, but I appreciate his craft. So even if I didn't like the movie, I like his craft and what he does. So, but I do think that some of these people in Room 237 are a little off the mark and a little too deep into the weeds of what The Shining is or what Stanley Kubrick intended. Granted, we'll never know, but I do understand the fun of overanalyzing something that you love. So I get why these people do it, but a part of me is just like, I can't handle it.
Let's just name check a couple of the theories. There's a Native American genocide theory. That's what The Shining is about.
Yes, which I buy into wholeheartedly. That's the easiest one for me to.
There's the Holocaust metaphor.
I also believe with that. Believe that too.
I think the hardest to buy into is the long-term conspiracy theory about Kubrick helping to fake the moon landing, and this film being his confession
to the American people.
Which I think is like the worst conspiracy theory.
Yeah, I don't know if I buy that. I think there are references to something to do with space travel in the film.
There definitely is.
It's pretty clear.
And he made 2001 A Space Odyssey. Kubrick did.
Yes.
Which is about space travel.
Yeah.
So it's something that obviously has been a part of his life and something he's thought quite a bit about. When you look at the space travel in 2001 A Space Odyssey, it's really meticulously done and brilliant.
Yes.
And
yeah. And because of his obsessiveness, it's easy to believe that he would put very hidden references to things in his movies. That's without question, I think.
He does it.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it's there for you to see. Whether or not he was confessing to the moon landing fabrication, I think. But that's why that Room 237 is an interesting film. It's now this is a film that belongs to the fans.
That's
true,
right.
True, true.
And they have made what they want out of it, and it's out of Kubrick's hands, it's out of Stephen King's hands, and now it's in our hands.
And even in the movie, they in Room 237, they talk about now that there's DVD and Blu-ray, they can watch frame by frame and break it apart frame by frame, these people. And it's probably, I don't know that it's the most studied film of the last 50 years, but
it's got to be close.
It's got to be close.
Yes.
It's hard to come up with another one that's more studied and more looked at than this movie, The Shining.
And even studying it backwards and forwards, which I find fascinating, running the film backwards.
That's true. That is
running
pretty
it forward,
cool.
Laying it over the images over one another. The film syncs up. I've done it. It seems to work. I don't know what his intention was. Something's going on.
Well, you said that it took 5 years to make this movie.
5 years.
So I feel like that alone kind of leads you to think that he definitely crafted this in different things, subtext-wise, in many layers. So I wouldn't be surprised that the backwards and forwards thing is true. Now, some of the other things, like Wonder Woman in the Room 237 swears she sees a Minotaur theme going out, and I right. just can't see it. Rusty sees
it. I see it.
But I, not for the life of me, do I see that. So, but I get it. You know, we were talking about how there's at some point the movies take on their own life with the fans and the viewers, and perhaps not what the director intended.
It doesn't matter anymore at that point.
Like, right. It's good to know what the director's intentions were, but what you as a viewer see could be completely different.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting that Stephen King's criticism of Stanley Kubrick was this great quote where he said, Stanley Kubrick is a director who thinks too much and feels too little.
Ouch. Ouch.
So wow. that he over-intellectualized the story.
I kind of buy a little bit.
Well, I think that's a legitimate...
Well, and coming from Stephen King, who's this guy who's a storyteller.
And he's very emotional, all of his...
And Stephen King, yeah. maybe some people would say feels too much and thinks too little.
Yes.
That's a good point.
I think you could flip it.
I think that's possibly. The literary right. criticism of Stephen King.
Yeah. Right.
That's
yeah.
true.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
So we could talk all week about
Room 237 and The Shining.
But Heather, what is your favorite Stephen King adaptation?
Well, I was going to go for Christine, but I changed my mind and I ended up deciding to watch The Running Man, which is one of his lesser known. And I did a little research and he wrote The Running Man book in 1 week. And he had it under his pseudonym, which was Richard Bachman, and he has a few novels under that pseudonym. And the book is much different than the Running Man movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Maria Conchita Alonso. And the Running Man movie is very much a product of the 80s action-packed Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
Funny one-liners.
Oh, it was from 1987. And one interesting thing, I thought they changed the director at the last minute. The director ended up being Paul Michael Glasser, who was Starsky.
Oh, Starsky, yes.
From the Starsky and Hutch TV show. And Arnold Schwarzenegger's complaint about The Running Man was that it was shot too much like a TV show. And if you look at Glasser's resume, you know, he's got a few movies under his belt, but he definitely mostly did TV, directing TV shows. So it's interesting,
but it's a film about a TV show.
But it's about a film about a TV show. So I felt like that was a weird criticism, but I get it, because if Schwarzenegger was going off the book, then I could see why his complaint, because the book has lots of depth. There's lots more going on rather than just the TV show. But for those of you who haven't seen it, it's about a dystopian future of a totalitarian government take place in 2017, which I always enjoy watching movies that are old that are supposed to take place now.
Around the corner.
Yeah. Right. And Ben Richards, who's played by Arnold Schwarzenegger, is a helicopter pilot, and he's during one of his missions, he's told to basically kill a bunch of innocent civilians, and he says, no, I'm not going to. And they basically, you know, attack him and take him out of that, and they send him to jail or prison, and they call it re-education camp or whatever. And it's basically labor camp. And what the government showed, they treat this story as something to propaganda. So they change and edit his story that he ended up killing all of these civilians, and that he's not the one that said, no, don't kill the civilians. And so they have this TV show called The Running Man, and it's hosted by none other than Richard Dawson, who did The Family Feud. And which was a great pick. I don't know how they got him, but anyways. So he plays the host of The Running Man. And so weekly, they have someone who I'm guessing they get from these labor camps, and they pick them, and they're the runners. And the runners run, and stalkers are like modern day. I mean, I guess American Gladiators actually was based off of The Running Man. Like, someone got this idea with less violence. Mm-hmm. And so their job, the runner's job, is to get away from the stalkers. The stalker's job is to kill the runners. And the idea is that at some point those runners were bad. They did something against the government or not followed society rules. You know, it's a very strict government and what you're supposed to do and not do. And so anyways, that's how it happens, you know. Maria Conchita Alonso plays one of the, woman that gets caught in the middle of things. Yes. And
it's very 80s.
You know, it's very 80s. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have a strong character. However, I will say, without her, they wouldn't have had the ending. So I did appreciate the ending, because we wouldn't have, like, it's so quickly. Ben Richards escapes. He ends up kidnapping Maria Conchita's character, Amber. They get caught. They both get arrested. He goes on to the Running Man TV show. She's there. And she's being treated at the time as an innocent victim. But later, she joins forces and tries to help Ben and the rebels escape and expose the government for what they are. And it's all very TV show. They have, you know, quick cuts. You know, tight, not a lot of wide shots. So I can see why he didn't like that, but it lends itself to the story so well. I'm not sure if it's the greatest criticism of him, but it's filled such a great one-liners. Like, he says the "I'll be back" line. He says he's fighting the stalkers who are played by American NFL players like Jim Brown,
right?
Jesse Ventura used to be, you know,
the Body.
The Running Man TV show is very much like a football game. This, you know, people are cheering. It gets like the whole audience involved. In between breaks, there's Richard Dawson's character giving them gifts, and there's dancers. There's even dancers, so like cheerleaders, if you will.
Yeah.
And they're like high cut leotards dancing to 80s electronic music. Anyways.
What a fun movie.
It's a fun movie. And, you know, like the like one of the leader of the rebellion is Mick Fleetwood, which is so random.
Oh.
And it was like, is that Mick Fleetwood? And sure enough, I was like, that's very odd.
So do you think Stephen King was prescient about reality television? Is that, because it seems it was a pretty early concept for a TV show like that.
Right. That's very true. I think so. And I think he was looking forward to the future in terms of how controlling television will be and what we view and how we take it and how a lot of people will get on the bandwagon to something. Because at the beginning of this movie, people are very anti-runners. They want the runners to die. But by the end, they find out they're starting to root for Ben Richards' character because he's killing all the stalkers, and he's doing it like not tricky. He's just doing it out of his own free will. Well, no choice, really. Mm-hmm. I either do this or I die.
Sure.
And so I think that, you know, kind of prescient idea of that. And in the book, though, it delves much more deeper into that stuff. And there's a whole more storyline. There's out of the, I think maybe his beef with the movie was that they didn't go into any of like the rebellion people, really. And the book ends much differently. It has nothing to do with the TV show. And so,
this is a testament to, I think, Stephen King maybe being smarter as a writer than some people give him credit for.
Yes.
Because he was actually doing a dystopian science fiction novel that was predicting the future in a way.
Right.
But he did it under his pseudonym, I think, because he said that he didn't know that people would accept that coming from Stephen King.
Right. Yeah, there's not, you know, the only really frightening parts are, you know, kind of when they're getting chased and stuff. And as a kid, I remember watching that a little bit, you know, kind of frightened, because the stalkers are very kind of frightening.
Yeah, there's
very
horror
impending.
In it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But not an overtly horror book or movie at all.
Right. So it's interesting that Stephen King thought of himself as a brand name that people expected a certain thing right. from. So he had to try and break away from that with the Richard Bachman character.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Carrie, the movie, and then The Shining, the movie, made him the horror writer movie guy of America, pretty right. much. I mean, yes. that vaulted him to almost superstardom very quickly.
60 movies.
I mean, that's amazing.
60 movies, yeah. 20 some TV series, miniseries, and there's more. There's more coming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think maybe his heyday as a movie adaptation person was in the 80s.
Yeah.
Late 70s through the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Firestarter, Cujo.
Christine.
God, I was so traumatized by Cujo.
And I just want to give a shout out maybe to like a film that was kind of towards the end of maybe his heyday was It.
Yes.
Which came out in 1990. It was a TV miniseries. And I wanted to give a shout out to this because A, it's terrifying, and B, because it is very timely with our current rash of clown sightings, which we're all being terrified by this year. Literally one of the most frightening clown characters in a film, I think, is Pennywise the Dancing Clown in It, played by Tim Curry. Nightmarish beyond belief. It's being remade next year. We'll see how that goes. But Stephen King will continue, I think, to haunt our nightmares for many, many years to come.
Yeah, and keep making great stuff. I watched for this podcast, I watched Under the Dome, the first season of Under the Dome, which is pretty much sci-fi. There are some horrific moments and some scary moments, but it's very, very watchable show, very fun and entertaining. I believe it's on Amazon Prime now. You can watch it. That's how I watched it. And it's really, really quite a good. The first season was really good. The second season I started watching it and I couldn't watch it anymore. It's not great filmmaking. It's, again, it's good storytelling. It's story that just keeps you wanting to know what's going to happen next. And even though I knew that the first season was not going to give me the resolution that I wanted, I still was ready to watch the whole thing and was pretty riveted.
Yeah.
And, you know, Walking Dead is a huge phenomenon now. Its best seasons, it's had about 13 million average viewers. Under the Dome had 11 million average viewers for its first season.
That's very popular.
Yeah. Very, very popular show and really good and really well made. And then obviously, I mean, Shawshank Redemption is something, not a horror movie, that people love. It's number one rated film on IMDb is The Shawshank
Stand
Redemption.
Stand By Me is another great one that's not a horror film. It's one of Stephen King's favorites of the adaptations of his books.
Yeah.
So I think he particularly lends himself well to the long form television format because the books are so long and plot driven. You almost need multiple hours, episodes to really tell the story the way, and I think that's why he's always uncomfortable with the feature films because they're 2 hours.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, like I did watch Christine, and the comparison with the book and Christine is that you don't get the juicy bits. You don't get to like get the in the depth the reason why Christine ends up being such a freaky car.
Right.
And you would need probably like a 6-episode series to do that. So yeah, it's true. I mean, I think maybe in the future they'll do more with his books that way than.
And Stephen King has, like you say, so many people go through Stephen King phases in their lives, but you see Stephen King all over now in other people's work. The work of J.J. Abrams, I think of specifically.
Oh, yes.
He's obviously a big Stephen King fan. When you look at Lost, I mean, that's almost, Stephen King could have written that.
Oh, yes. And if you look at the show Stranger Things.
Absolutely.
Clearly, that was influenced by Stephen King and It in particular and a lot of Stephen King, Stand By Me. And so his influence is very strong.
Yeah.
Very, very strong on other artists. So go out and read a Stephen King book and then go watch a Stephen King movie.
Yes.
And see what happens.
Yeah. Boo.
Boo. Boo. For Halloween. Yeah, please join us next time on the Mini Rules of Film Club, where we're going to look at rule number 111, which is never discount a girl named Buffy, as we look at the output of the great Joss Whedon.
Woohoo!
Yes, including Buffy and other things as well. So please check us out on the miniRulesOfFilmClub.com. Give us your suggestions. Give us your feedback. Check us out on Facebook. You can check us out on iTunes as well. And we're going to be here talking about movies.
That's right. That's
forever.
Right. For a long time.
Yeah. So thanks, Rusty. Thanks, Heather.
Thanks, Jeff.
Oh, sure. This has been fun.
And happy Halloween. And we'll see you next time on the Mini Rules of Film Club.